Hello and welcome to the third season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name is Lewis Webb and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. This week we'll hear from Froome-based five-piece Hello Hopeville. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is one of the country's foremost architectural joiners, the founder and creative director of Artichoke, Bruce Hodgson. Based in Cheddar, Bruce has, over the last 30 years, designed and created interiors for some of the world's finest and most historical homes. With an ethos that combines technical craftsmanship, historical preservation and stunning design, Bruce's vision has created a business that's placed its stamp on properties from Jacobean manor houses to villas in Tuscany. Bruce, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you for having me.
Are you a podcast fan? Do you listen to many?
I'm ashamed to say not many. My kids send me links to things they think I should listen to, so occasionally I listen to them. I do occasionally listen to them in the bath, but life's pretty busy, so... I don't seem to find the time that often.
Do you have anything on while you're working? Do you have music on, or does it really depend kind of what type of mindset you're trying to be in?
When I'm drawing, and I quite often catch up at the weekends because I manage a design team, so a lot of the time I'm editing through the working day. Sometimes I just need to exclude myself to work out a scheme, and I find I like listening to Guy Garvey on Six Music. He's my sort of favourite go-to DJ, but I tend to listen to quite a lot of cello music and classical music when I'm drawing, because it doesn't distract me, but I find it relaxing, and without sounding too pretentious, I find listening to Bach and his rhythms and so on really useful. You know, it sets a pace, and I like the repetitive nature of it, but... Yeah, so by and large, during the working day, I'm listening to the detritus sound in the office, but most of the time I'm at home, I'll listen to music. Hmm.
Your career before Artichoke was in the army. Did you come from a military family?
No, I didn't. Not in the immediate generations, but no, I joined the army after school, and I went straight in. I had a sort of 6-month session of working on the roads. Actually, I built the flyover, the M25 and the M4, as a road labourer. But no, I left school and went straight into Sandhurst, and that was my further education, really. Well, I went through a typical traditional education, and I think at that time, the crafts and creative world wasn't really respected as a viable way of making a living. It was seen more as a hobby. And so 6 years in the army, I think it helped me grow up a bit, and it also gave me a good period of time to really stop and think about what I wanted to do with my future. In fact, I was very happy in the army. I enjoyed it. I was in the infantry, and I was in an excellent regiment, and which has now become the Rifles. And actually, it was a very creative environment. I think traditionally the army is seen as a sort of highly disciplined, and everything's a roadmap for you. But actually, the reality is they teach young people, and particularly young commanders, to, whether you're an NCO or an officer, you know, to make decisions and to take a lot of responsibility and be quite creative with your thinking, because obviously the nature of soldiering and the things you have to get up to, you know, you can't control. You control everything to a start line, but after that, everything's chaos. So you have to learn how to manage what comes at you. Mm. So yeah, so no military background. I went into, because I liked being outdoors. I liked shooting. I was a rifle shot at school, and it just appealed to me, and I had a great time. But I decided to leave once I met my wife, and I felt that she wouldn't enjoy being dragged around as an army wife.
You mentioned school. You were at Sedba, a very old school, kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Pretty much.
What are your memories of that time?
Well, I have very mixed memories about Sedba. Sedba was an amazing, it is an amazing location. So the whole ethos of the school, which I learned later, was about prolonging childhood. And in those days, it was an all-boys school. So their whole ethos was about, was saying that, you know, you can learn to ride a bike quite quickly. So, you know, forget about all the distractions of the outside world. And they focused very heavily on physical activity and outward bound. And it was a very sporty school. I was lucky I enjoyed those sorts of activities. But if you didn't, it was pretty brutal. We wore shorts, for example, all the way through to the sixth form, winter, summer, hail, rain, snow. We had quite a lot of weather at Sedba. I have to say, that it was a brutal school in many ways, in that it hadn't evolved in the 70s and 80s into the sorts of schools that boarding schools are today, you know, with good care of young people. In many ways, there was a lot of bullying, and I was subjected to that for a good while, and I found it that pretty arduous. But in other ways, the school was amazing. So it had a great design and technology department, for example, which I found myself in a lot, and where I was one of those kids that found themselves in the garage at weekends making toy boats or whatever I had in mind, and banging away with hammers and nails and so on. So they had a great design technology department, and that drew me in, and some great teachers there. So I could do anything from modelling in clay to wiring a earphone socket into a radio to listen to Radio Caroline or whatever it was in those days, you know, illegally at night. But yeah, so mixed memories. I didn't really develop academically till I was in my mid-teens, and so I sort of struggled away with those traditional lessons. But creatively, we used to have to make our own fun, because as you pointed out, it was in the middle of nowhere. So there was a lot of theatre and a lot of music. I played the cello, and I was interested in performance and so on. So I have very mixed memories of it, but I think it's a pretty epic place to be brought up. Mm. It set me up for being cold and wet and being used to that. So that was good for the army, but it was very traditional. And looking back, I feel that had somebody recognised my skills in design or my ability to draw, I would have perhaps gone another route. I might have missed out the 6 years in the forces and ended up doing something more creative at university or following a sort of art career. But you know, when you look back at your life, it's quite difficult, isn't it? You make decisions or decisions are taken for you, and you make the most of it. And I suppose you can't change any of that. So that's the way it is.
Did you find most satisfaction then in the tinkering and the creation of things in the garage that you mentioned, or in the shed, or in the woodwork studio, or whatever it was? Doing things with your hands, I suppose.
Yeah, it seemed to be the most natural place to be for me. You know, I think that there's a mass generalisation, but I think the world's made up of people who think in three dimensions and others who think in two. And it's a bit like oil and water. And my mind, you know, I used to look at buildings or look at things, and my instincts were always to work out how they were made, and that's what interested me, more so than working out equations or learning Latin. So they were things that came easily, and if I picked up tools, I always felt I had a sort of natural dexterity with tools, and I didn't find them complicated to use, or you know, that sort of touch feel that you have to work material, particularly with wood, that just was very natural. So it was a it was a godsend to have that as a place to recuperate and to get away from the sort of chaos of, and the busyness of school life. So it was a place where I felt like I could excel, and I was interested in it. Mm. We had the most amazing facilities, so everything from a furnace to a blacksmith to a fantastic ceramic studio where you can go and turn a pot and everything in between. We once built a hovercraft, for example, we drove it around the games pitches sideways, out of control, but it was brilliant fun. And certainly for me, it was the perfect antidote to the sort of stress of the academic side.
Your time in the army then, post Sandhurst, if my research is correct, the regiment that you were in was posted to Northern Ireland during the late 80s, which was obviously a period of conflict there. How did being there affect you?
Well, I had the dubious pleasure of being the youngest commissioned officer in the British Army for 6 months. I left Sandhurst, and my battalion, which was the 2nd Battalion of Light Infantry, was posted to West Belfast in 1987. So when I arrived in the battalion, the first 6 months were intensive training to learn how to deal with that theatre of operations. I was really young. I was 19 years old, and I was in charge of a platoon of about 38 men. You're intelligently that they sort of partner you up with a platoon sergeant who's more senior and long in the tooth, and I certainly had that chap. And I think at that age, you had no responsibilities other than to yourself and to the platoon. And I was physically very confident, and I felt well trained and well prepared. So to that extent, you're bulletproof. And when you first arrive out there, I had all sorts of, slightly naive aspirations that we're going to make a difference and we're going to win the hearts and minds of the patch that we were in West Belfast, and we're going to leave the place a better place. And pretty much, I would say after 2 or 3 weeks of being there, I decided that my main objective was getting everybody back in one piece. It was a boiling pot of deep-rooted hatred and anger, and we were just uniforms on patrol, and it was difficult to... It was a really, it was like a sensory overload, to be honest. When you first step out with a live weapon in your hands and you're let loose on the streets and, you're trying to simulate everything that's going on. We had a pretty rough tour in terms of contacts. I think the battalion had 52 serious contacts, which were described as either bombs or shootings at us. So it was really busy. You get used to an anxiety level. You get to a heightened sense of sensitivities. You become very alert when you're out on patrol. You would notice the difference in the urban environment when things changed. You would notice that there should be people on the street right now and there aren't. It sounds obvious, but they used to dissipate very quickly. And we find out that an ice cream van is playing the tune Green Sleeves, which was the signal that something was about to happen. All the civilians should leave the street, and they did. And lo and behold, somebody would shoot at you, or an IED would go off, or something like that. So, yeah, it was a fascinating period. I learned so much from it, and the camaraderie that we developed as a team of people, and I learned a lot about how to manage people and what motivated them, and you're living cheek by jowl with people who come from very different backgrounds and with a very different level of education. But actually, one of the things I've learned was that despite their education, there was some very, very intelligent men in the team, and so together we got through it. So I look back on my trips to Northern Ireland. Well, I look back on that time with an immense sense of pride, actually. I think we actually achieved quite a lot. We all got back in one piece in my platoon, and I actually think we did leave the patch a better place. Sadly, a Scottish regiment took over from us, and I think they probably managed to destroy the relationships we built within a few weeks, but that's the way it worked back then. Funnily enough, we've got a project in Northern Ireland at the moment, and I decided to go over there and take a little detour through the old patch, and felt distinctly uncomfortable and decided to get out pretty quickly, actually, because it didn't feel like it changed much. I mean, it felt like it was underneath. So it's quite interesting politically, but I wish it well. I think it's going to take several generations to bleed out that sort of animosity.
So you met your wife and decided that, yeah, that career wasn't necessarily the right place for the two of you to be together and to start a family. How did you decide what to do next?
I mentioned earlier that the army is quite a creative place. And so if you're digging a trench, I would take great pride in making sure that my trench was absolutely immaculate and very tidily put together and comfortable. And so I knew that I had a sort of attention to detail and a perfectionism that was in my nature and that was difficult. And I used to dream about what I was going to do next. Tess was working as a fashion model in London, and she was being very well paid and was being successful at it. So initially, my thoughts turned to furniture, and I had this sort of dream of growing veg and living an alternative life down in Devon, and if the weather was good, going for a swim, and if it wasn't, I'd be making or something like that. But the reality is very different, and trying to make a living and pay the bills meant that I had to be a bit more commercial about it. I was lucky. I had a week's leave, and I decided that I wanted to marry Tess, and she was working that week, so I went up to London to stay with her, and I went to a pub, the Alma in Wandsworth town, and went to the pub for lunch and sat next to a guy who owned a joinery business, and he got chatting to me. He was having a sandwich, and I said I was interested in furniture making. He said, well, why don't you come back come and work for me, do some work experience this week. And at the end of that week, he offered me the job as his general manager. So I went back and resigned and left and got married. And pretty much 3 weeks later, after our honeymoon, turned up at his doorstep, pretty green. And the rest is history. But I spent a year with him. We made bookcases and wardrobes and alcove cupboards and that sort of stuff. And he had some contracts with lawyers, chambers in the Inner Temple and so on. So I cut my teeth on that, and I went off to the London College of Furniture to do a part-time City and Guilds in cabinet making. And that was supposed to take 2 years, but I completed it in a year. The process, it was quite amusing that you would turn up on week one and you're shown how to sharpen your tools and so on. And then we were set a project, and it was to make a music stand, a portable music stand. I made it out of London plane. So I went to the workshop that weekend, made it, designed it, made it, took it to them the following week. And they said, that's supposed to take you 3 months. So I said to them, I'm in a hurry, you know, I've got a life to lead and want to get on. So they were very kind, and then they negotiated a deal with me where I could fast track the City and Guilds, which I did. And actually in 9 months, I completed the course and got my accreditation and went on.
Great.
So, I mean, it was different for me because I was practicing it day in, day out. So, you know, I was on a fast learning track, really.
And then I know the Somerset area is obviously now central to your business and your family life as well. What prompted the move away from London?
Well, Tess became pregnant. The company I was working for had no progression in it for me. You know, I was working very long hours, and the guy who ran it wasn't really, his business plan wasn't to expand or to hand over the reins. He wasn't very good at delegating and so on. So I decided, well, you know, we couldn't afford to bring up a kid in London. Let's get out. And I'm not an urban dweller. So we moved to Bristol, where Tess is from. And actually, I was looking for a job. I didn't feel confident enough to start my own business or become self-employed. But I couldn't find a job. And then at the same time, we bought an old, you know, Victorian terrace house, which was in pretty poor repair. And we bought it off Tess's self-employed books, which was interesting because she was 7 months pregnant when we did it. So we sort of baggy jumpers in the middle of August going to sign mortgage documents. And then I set about knocking the house about, and we had a diminishing pot of cash, which we'd saved. And I couldn't find a job that I felt passionate about. You know, nothing appealed to me, and I wasn't actually looking in the joinery realm. I then saw an advert to go and work for Bath Cabinet Makers as a production manager, and to my massive surprise, it's quite a big organization, they gave it to me. And they just won a contract with G-Plan to manufacture a range of furniture for them. And so 7 weeks later was my start date. I thought, perfect, I'll rip down the kitchen extension, rebuild it, and all will be fine. And I turned up at the front gate, having had no communication with them. And of course, in those days, there were no mobile phones or email. So I just turned up on the allotted day, and to find a sign hanging on the gate saying it's gone into liquidation. So I returned home in my suit and said, right, we're going to have to rethink. So I became self-employed. A friend of my mother-in-law wanted some bookcases making. I met them at a Sunday lunch and said I could do them. And I rented a room in the Enterprise Workshops in St. Paul's in Bristol, there were two Enterprise Workshops. This was in an underground car park in the centre of St. Paul's. It was a pretty choice area to be working in those days. It was had an edge to it, and used to lock myself in the room. So the first thing I did was build a bench. I would buy, in those days it was MDF, I'm afraid, and I bought all the sheet material, cut it up with a jigsaw, routed straight edges onto it, and got on and made these bookcases, delivered them. They had a dinner party that night, and two of their guests rang me the following week and asked me to make furniture for them. And that's how we started. So there was no great business plan. It really happened by default. You know, it was just an opportunity, and I took it because it seemed to be more interesting and cash. You know, I needed cash at the time. Yeah. So we got on with it.
And while you were starting your own business, you were also starting a family as well. So I'd imagine that was a pretty challenging time.
Yeah, well, we did space them out. So we have three children, Rosie, Flora and Douglas, and they were 3 years apart. Nature did that for us. But yes, there was a lot of work. You know, I think in the early days to make ends meet, because you make a lot of mistakes, of course, because you don't know what you're doing. So things take longer and you go up a lot of blind alleys, and so you have to reverse out of those and go again. I worked many, many hours. You know, I mean, it was 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock, whatever, back for some supper, into bed, you know, crying child through the evenings, all that kind of stuff. So we've all been there. I think it's quite familiar territory. But, and Tess was incredibly, she's always been amazingly supportive. She's a very hardworking and committed mother, and she's helped. I used to come back and look after Rosie when she was a baby on Sunday, and she would go into the workshop and paint. She's actually a fantastic furniture painter, amongst many other things that she's done along the way. But yeah, that's how we managed it, really. And then one year led to another, and things grew. And We had a habit of buying derelict houses, so we would do one up, to work out whether we could live in the next one or not, which we always did, without heating and floors and so on. And I would build those at the weekends or in the evenings, and that way we made a bit of capital doing it as well, and that enabled us to sort of move up the property ladder. Yeah, so it's 25, well, it's actually been 30 years now, but and I'm still doing up houses and living, but it's a very difficult habit to stop.
Yeah,
but that's how it was in the early days. And in the early days, you know, people would ring up and I'd take pretty much anything on that came in, which was a great training ground. Wasn't always very commercially sound. And I think the first two things I actually made apart from the bookcases, one was a garden gate. Another was a table from some roof timber, some old elm 1600 roof tables, rafters that were elm and full of metal and nails and so on, making a table out of those, which was almost impossible, but I managed it just about. I even fitted a cap flap for money, you know. So in those days, it's just whatever came in.
You'd obviously made things before, but making things that people have commissioned and that are paying you as, you know, your own business, how is that different from, you know, anything you'd done before then?
Well, of course, their expectations and their briefs were interesting to work to. And that's when I really started to think about design. I think, you know, I made lots of tables and the sorts of things that the marketplace that I was connected to could afford. And having bespoke furniture made is expensive stuff, you know. And so in those days, I was sort of working for the income levels of local GPs and that kind of market. And of course, they all know each other, so you got referred around and so on. But I pretty quickly learned that for me, commercially, to make money out of it or to make a living out of it, excuse me, there's a helicopter flying by for some reason. And I very quickly learned that, you know, if you were to take on a project such as a kitchen, the design process back then would maybe take me 40 hours. Actually, to design a table would take a similar amount of time to do it really well. But the outcome would be very different in terms of man hours that it would supply you with work. So to make a kitchen might take 500 hours, or nowadays it takes us 1500 hours perhaps, but for lots of reasons. But back then it was hundreds of hours rather than 40 or 60 hours to make the table. So the effort to design and the time you put in resulted in a lot more revenue. And in those days, I didn't feel comfortable about charging for my design. I didn't value it in that way. I saw it as the end product. And then I had a sister. I have a sister who, I have two sisters and a brother. And one of them was working in the banking world in London in the 80s. And, you know, they were all in that sort of yuppie stage and buying their own houses in Clapham and those sorts of areas. And my sister needed a kitchen. So, and she was a great guinea pig, because, you know, when you go and you face a kitchen for the first time, you think, God, well, what do you have to do in this environment? I need a cooker, I need a sink, and how does that work, and so on. So you work it all out. I did a really nice job for her, and she got a bargain basement, brotherly love price. And of course, all her friends started wanting them too. And some of her friends went on to be quite successful in the financial world. And as they moved houses, they would bring me in, and I would do another project for them. And then I'd meet their architect, and you begin to build a network. And that's really, really when my interest in design and in the social goings on of a household started to evolve. And it reflects now pretty much on everything that we do. If you think about how furniture and joinery organizes a home, you know, every household lives differently, and the households that we're dealing with today are very different to the ones, you know, back then, which might have been sort of, you know, a young couple with a young child, with three bedrooms and not enough living space, at which point you would cram in as much as you possibly could in storage terms and then make it as beautiful as possible, but function would really dictate form. Whereas today we're very lucky where we have patrons who the financial side of things isn't their first issue by any means, and you know what they're looking for. Quite often they come to us, they don't really realize this, but actually what we do is do a sort of sociological study of how this household operates. Typically the houses are really large. Quite often they're being repurposed because they're historic and they were made for another period where people lived in a different way. And so we're trying to evolve a property, put work into it that will enhance the architecture and will develop the house for another 200 years. You know, the work we're doing is made in a way that will be there in the same way as Georgian joinery is today, still being utilized by homeowners. And then it's having worked out how they live, what they need, how they function. We are then developing rooms that are coherent and sympathetic to the architecture. We're not particularly interested in trends because trends come and go. And if you do something that's highly fashionable today and it looks outdated in 20 years' time, it's a huge cost to replace. So, and also, you know, I mean, without getting too woke about the whole thing, but we, you know, we get through a lot of materials and it upsets me when they're wasted because they take a very long time to grow. And, you know, we're all very conscious today of the resources that this world has. Mm. I think we have to use them responsibly. And so you know, we take great care in making sure a household functions well. And for us, a great result is when the family will let us know down the line that the house is a joy to live in and we've resolved all of their conundrums.
You're obviously, you know, known more now for those sort of heritage and historical properties and the projects around them. For you, is there a golden age of architectural joinery?
Yeah, there's many, actually. Goodness. I suppose post-industrial revolution is the area that I'm really interested in. You know, when water power and steam power were able to spin tools, and therefore moldings could become more prevalent in their use. And moldings, of course, are used in architecture to decorate and to cast shadows and to create hierarchy and form. And if you go to Blenheim Palace and you strip the rooms of its fibrous plaster and architectural joinery, you're left with a big box. And it's no different. Every room is like that. So the embellishments of rooms really is created. The embellishments are the joinery, and then there's the decoration and the furnishing and so on. But the hard surfaces, if you like, the sort of core base of a room comes off often from architectural joinery and from fibrous plaster. You know, I love the Georgian work. I think they cracked light. You know, I like the hierarchies they used. I love that. I mean, it's so quintessentially English, isn't it? A good Georgian house and the sort of feel of that domestic, we call it estate furniture. Quite often in large country houses, the furniture was made by an estate craftsman or two, and they were permanently there and they were sort of upkeeping the building. I love their techniques. I think they were very thorough. They were great engineers, and they refined things. The Victorian period, I'm less attracted to, but I suppose my golden age is the Edwardian period. And my hero in architecture is probably Lutyens. But I love that arts and crafts Edwardian period, you know, where you know, the likes of Ruskin and, you know, really pursued playful architecture. You know, they weren't hung up on you know, am I being studious and academic about the merger of a 15th century castle and a Jacobean wing and then a Georgian facade that has sort of overlaid the Jacobean, and they've bugged around with the interior dimensions and so on, and you get this sort of hodgepodge of a evolved country house. And then the Edwardians came along and said, okay, we're going to make these buildings really serviceable. And when they typically, with the introduction of electricity into homes, started to domesticate homes in a way that you haven't previously seen. So I'm very interested in Edwardian architecture, and I think those homes must have been magnificent in their day when they were functioning as they were meant to be, you know, with sculleries and meat rooms and flower rooms and so on. You know, it's really, it attracts me.
And your own house is one with a lot of history as well. Do you identify as sort of a steward of history and that historical character?
Yeah, it's been a playground, actually. It's been, the house I live in at the moment is a Somerset longhouse. It's a very rudimentary, rustic building. It's in a fabulous location. It's fabulous views are up on the hill. The house is very simple. Sadly, it wasn't, you know, it's been used as a farm for many centuries. So it was built in 1600, thereabouts. We've been able to ascertain that, not through deeds, but through the carpentry structure of the roof. And so when you look at the truss design and how it was built, you can actually, and also we've recently stripped the longhouse of all of its plaster, and because it had lots of cementitious based plasters and lots of rotting lintels, and basically had no foundations on the internal walls, which had rotted away. So I had to strip it back to bare bones to work out what could be kept and what had to be replaced. Obviously, budget's an issue, so that helps you form decisions. And but it's very interesting. You can see the evolution of the building. So initially it started as a single floor dwelling. It probably had two rooms. One was the living room and the kitchen, and the other ones where the cows were barred in over winter, and has a long passageway that goes through the middle of the house. And then you can see where they added a second floor. And so they raised the walls to low eaves height, and took out the bread oven, and it's when they put a staircase in, and I think that's around about 1680. I think it's during the Reformation, and I think Somerset became quite well rewarded by Charles II for their loyalty, and I think there's a lot of prosperity at that time. So you see an evolution, and where they move the cattle out of the house and into barns and so on. So I've definitely put, you know, we've used traditional building techniques. We've put life back into the house, and I feel I'm a perfectionist, and my friends and family think I'm mad, but every detail counts, and doing it slowly means you get every detail right. And I've been I've been the architect of the project. So there is a limit to how much output I can put in without going crazy, you know, without losing my mental health because of exhaustion, and living a life and having fun alongside it. So I take time over it to get the details right. So otherwise a building team runs away with the project and they make decisions on my behalf that I wouldn't necessarily make, and, you know, that's a compromise, and I know I can do it better. So, yeah, I must be a bit of a nightmare to work for in that way.
Jumping forward to modern times and modern sort of architecture and house furnishing, what do you think, aside from cost, has driven the sort of rise in fast furniture and the move away from that traditional craftsmanship approach?
I think it's two things. I think cost is actually really important, because, you know, hand labour in the UK is expensive, and the cost of living is expensive, and that dries up. So for people to furnish their homes, there has been a move for new furniture, and the rise of places like IKEA have provided accessible furnishings for most people. And to make it accessible, they have to automate the manufacture of it and to cut out detail. And so most of it's made by slabs of man-made board with horrible finishes and very plasticated and but highly functional. And if you take the interiors of new builds and so on, again, because to keep the build costs down, they don't develop the interiors in the same way. So there's this move to much more contemporary pared back living, and that in itself takes less skill, and the whole thing is self-perpetuating. So, you know, it's a viable trend that that I completely understand, and if it's done well, it's in itself can be a very attractive spaces to live. I don't think that family life works well in minimalism. Shoving things in drawers when people come around to show you in your perfect environment, it's just not realistic, is it? I mean, it's just unrealistic, and I think it's devoid of decoration and devoid of interesting decoration. I think it's out of vogue, the kind of Victorian level of decoration, but actually when you really study it, you think, God, these guys were really, really creative. They really had something. And I think our lives can be impoverished by not having it about. So I think the drive to modernist furniture and simplicity, you know, I think it really has been driven by time and affordability, which is a shame. I think there's also been a resurgence since the last recession in an understanding of the value of enjoying what you do as a job, rather than being on Maggie Thatcher's kind of train of, you know, must work harder, must get on the train in the morning, travel for an hour, go and sit behind a computer, get back. So I've noticed a lot in my eldest daughter's generation. She's absolutely typical of the younger people we have in our workshop, where they went off driven by a traditional education where the creative arts simply weren't valued. And you know, we've been sort of churning out maths, English, languages, sciences, etc., all very important, but undervaluing the value of creativity. So they go off into the workplace, they do some degree they're not passionate about. I'm really describing my eldest daughter. They go off trying to find themselves for a few years. She went off 5 years, she went off finding herself, skiing around the world, and had a pretty good time, I think. But she came back to the workshop and hadn't seen it because we built it in her absence. And she went, oh my God, I want to work in here. This looks amazing place to be, and which it is. And she was always very creative as a child, you know, great at drawing and so on. So she went off and became trained as a cabinet maker, came back and is now working as one of our junior cabinet makers in the team, which has been for 2 years. And I see that a lot. You know, we get a lot of people changing direction in their mid-20s, you know, when they've worked out who they are a bit and they're drawn to it and they see it as a possibility. I'm also a governor of the Building Crafts College. I'm a liveryman of the Carpenters Company and seconded to the board there. And I'm involved with their marketing, and I'm involved with their standards and curriculum and so on. I'm trying to make it relevant for the furniture making industry. So what they're teaching is relevant, and people can actually come out and become functional makers and from the course or from their courses. And this last year in lockdown, where we've been doing everything on Zoom, there's just been an absolute flood of 20 to 30 year olds who are clamoring to get in, and we're oversubscribed. And we have approaches all the time from young people who want to make the change. Conversely, we also have most of our clients, and I have to say, you know, most of our clients are richer than I could ever imagine, and have accumulated vast wealth, and they come into the workshop when we can get them there. We always love to get them there because it completely transforms their insights to, you know, what they're buying. And we think they should be involved. They should be enjoying this process of commissioning wonderful interiors for their homes and understand the craft and the labor and the skills and the technology that goes into it. And when we get them into the workshop, they're always, you know, they, I often have grown men saying, I wish I'd, you know, who have their own private yachts, wishing they'd taken their career in furniture making. You know, I don't quite believe them, but you know, it does seem to have that impact on people.
As a new feature for this season, we're showcasing Somerset's musical talent with tracks from local acts in each podcast. Hello Hopeville are a five-piece group based in Frome that combine the traditional Irish music heritage with the sound of the Deep South blues. Lisa, Frank, Zach, Keith and Richard have performed at Glastonbury's Pilton Stage, the Somerset Festival in Taunton, and many other local locations. Here's Hello Hopeville with their take on the 19th century American folk song, Jesse James.
Jesse James, we understand, little man, he a man, he robbed Union trains. He stole from the rich, he gave to the poor. He'd a heart and a hand and a brain. Well, it was Robert Ford, that dirty little coward. I wonder how he feels, for he ate up Jesse's bread and slept. Jesse's bed, he laid poor Jesse in his grave. Jesse had a wife to mourn for his life, three children nail brave. But the dirty little coward, a shot Mr. Howard, laid poor Jesse in his grave. Jesse was a man, a friend to the poor, never robbed a mother or a child. There never was a man with a law in his hand that could take Jesse James when alive. It was on a Friday night, the moon was shining bright. They robbed the Glendale train, and the people laid it slay, or many miles away, was those outlaws, Frank and Jesse James. Jesse had a wife to mourn for his life, three children nail brave. But the dirty little coward that shot Mr. Howard lay poor Jesse in his grave. Jesse's death, I wondered how he ever came to fall. It was Robert Ford, in fact, who shot him in the back, while Jesse hung a picture on the wall. Jesse went to rest with his head on his breast, the devil upon his knee. He was born one day in the county clay, and he came from a solitary race. Jesse had a wife to mourn for his life, three children they were brave. But the dirty little coward, a shot Mr. Howard, lay poor Jesse, lay Jesse James in his grave.
Working with older properties, there can often be little sort of secrets or hidden gems or bits of history about the property. As you said, you know, it was previously used in a slightly different way. Have you come across any examples of that?
Lots, I think. We were working in a house that was built on the battlefield of Bosworth. And it was a Jacobean house, and it was used as a prisoner of war camp for German officers during the Second World War. And one of the projects we undertook, amongst many in the house, was to make a two-story library study. It was a bit like Dumbledore's office. Cross between that and sort of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It was really good fun. But when lifting the floorboards, we found a stash of a German officer's contraband. So there were his cash and cigarettes and this, that, and the other. I can only just, and all his letters from his wife, which were really beautiful. And we had them. A few translated, a friend of mine's German, she translated them for me, and then we sent them back to the address they came from. Whether they were returned to their owner or not, we don't know, but or to the family, I don't know. But yeah, so that was interesting. We come across the old priest hole. We come across some really interesting engineering structures. So I can remember working in Queen's Charlotte Street in a beautiful Georgian house, untouched, in, I think it's Mayfair, I think, isn't it? Queen Charlotte Street. So, and the way the floor joists were cut, and each joist was cut into the principal beam through an angled dovetail, and they created sort of bracing at angles. So you learn things about how they put houses together. The Victorians did a very simple thing with floor structures, you know, where they had thick walls on the ground floor, rested their joists on the parapet, as it were, and then thinner walls and finally a single skin wall on the top floor. Things like that, you know, that sort of building technology you discover along the way. I enjoy that. I think also when you find a house that has been heavily, it's lost its way, you know, we've all seen them when the house has just been renovated and altered and changed and, you know, partitions put up and it's become a dentist's practice or something like that. And it gets acquired by somebody who really wants to put it back on as it should be. And they sensitively strip back and pare back and pare back all the various coverings that have been laid over it over the years. And then you get back to the center of things, and it's just amazing. Mm. And as a particular house, which I can't mention its name, but it's a house not far from Bruton, and the house wasn't listed. And from the first day I arrived, it was sort of a windswept, miserable day, and looked at this sort of pebble-dashed, very dull-looking 1930s farmhouse. I mean, my God, yeah, it's a great site, but what a dump. And anyway, I was lucky it wasn't listed, because by the time it had been stripped back, as I described, we found a 13th century wind-braced carved roof, and it was a great hall and absolutely stunning building, absolutely amazing. And the owner of the building has put it back to in such a beautiful way, with such sensitivity and care. And it was all done outside of the listing, which was because it wasn't listed. So it was legal to do it and so on. And as a result, I actually think it's better as a building, because it hasn't had they're a very creative family, so they haven't been constrained, if you like.
As well as that one, which sounds like a real project that embodies the ethos and the values of what you're trying to achieve, is there a single project that you look back at and think, this defines everything that I want to do with the company, with my creativity?
Well, I mean, yes, there are many. There's one house where we're coming to the end. We often get involved, you know, we enter through the kitchen, and then which we're obviously known for, and where we're producing, you know, we're trying to create rooms where you walk into them and feel at ease immediately. You feel like this room's been there for generations, and it just works beautifully. So there's a house up in Staffordshire where we've been working. It's a great grade two star Jacobean house, unfortunately riddled with Death Watch beetle, but we've been working our way through it, and from library, studies, dressing rooms. The client has been a great patron and is also a designer, so he has driven an agenda where he, I would be slightly conservative about maybe a response to a space like the library, and he would say, now we can, surely we can embellish it further. And I was going, okay, so what do you have in mind? And he said, well, let's introduce some brass detailing. So off we go. And in collaboration, that's really pushed, it's really pushed our skills, and it's really challenged us to think more deeply. And in fact, I think it was a watershed where I realized that, actually clients often are limited by what they know they can do. And actually often our job is to do the non-obvious and to challenge their thought process and to show them what's possible if they want to go there. And this building's really done that. So it's made a big difference to the way I look at work. And also, one of the things which has taught me is to speak truth to power. This is a collaboration with clients. We're working in their homes, but they only get access to this stuff through people, artisans like us and others who are involved with the projects. So they have to work in collaboration in that sense, to get the best out of us. And it doesn't feel like a sort of servant-master relationship. Whereas, 20 years ago, I spent over backwards to make sure everybody was absolutely kind of well-serviced and so on. Of course, we do that now anyway, but it's in our culture. But we're about creating, our strap line, we thought about it long and hard, and our strap line, which we originated maybe four or five years ago, was creating Britain's future heritage. But then we've actually refined it recently, and we just realized it's about creating history. We're creating future history with the work we're doing in the houses.
Therefore, beyond the technical skills and abilities that you need to actually do the work, what do you look for in your team to be able to create future history?
That's a very good question. Super important. I think we employ 52 people. I'm not the managing director any longer. I'm the creative director, and one of my colleagues took over that role when we got larger, and he's very good at it. So the culture of our business is really, really important, and it's taken me 30 years to bring together a very wide variety of skills, from very skilled draftsmen, creative designers, great project managers, people who are good at handling client relationships, production managers who care about making sure that all of our machinery is up to date and that our manufacturing techniques are current, and we're well equipped, and Kanban and Kaizen and all these production processes that make you as efficient as possible, through to finishing skills where we're playing with alchemy and so on. So, we have collected together with, a vast array of really talented and motivated people who are passionate about making beautiful things as well as they can. And sometimes people arrive in the team and you don't really know what you've got until they've worked with you for a while. But sometimes they arrive and their attitude just doesn't fit. They like taking shortcuts and so on. So one of the ways that we will take an apprentice on is that we'll take a few people in who are interested in an apprenticeship for the following year, and then we will set them the task of washing a car in the car park, every lunchtime, and they take it in turns. And little do they know that we put a toothbrush in the bottom of the bucket, and the person we'll take on for the apprenticeship is the person who wants to take a toothbrush to the hubcaps of the wheel, and they do that without being asked. So that attention to detail and that personal drive is super important. It's nothing's it's a sort of heel and toe approach. You know, you've got to polish the heel as well as the toe. So that's really important. But culture's also important. So we have, I mean, we're changing a lot at the moment. You know, we have quite a few female cabinet makers, which is brilliant. I think they are very, very suited to the job. It's been traditionally very male orientated. And my daughter's been really useful having them there. So she will say to me, you know, why are we being asked to lift the same loads as the men? And you think, of course, this is ridiculous. All they're getting is repetitive strain injuries and so on. So we're evolving and becoming less of a sort of dinosaur in that sense. But the big thing that's going on that really motivates and is what we're looking for in people is their fit culturally, who really, you know, have a passion for making. Is that I'm going a bit off track, but I think it's important to mention, is that we're becoming an employee-owned trust. And you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and at some point in the next 10 years, I'd like to be able to take it a bit easier, and I feel like I've earned it. And I've got to retire at some time, and you know, you've got to create space for the younger members of the team who are, they've got their careers in front of them. So, you know, we looked at how to manage that succession, and you do it, you can obviously hold on to the company and, you know, take a dividend, or you sell the company. And every time I've seen anybody sell our type of business, the company just dissolves in 2 or 3 years because the new owner has a completely different culture or a completely different driver. And so we've chosen to go down this route. So the staff will own the company in eventually, we're starting it this year, and really the company gets gifted to the staff. My shares are bought off of me by the trust that we set up, and that happens as over time. And that for me is a perfect circle. You know, I'm very proud of that, and it means that the culture that that we have set up about this kind of caring for each other, a pursuit of excellence, investing in the future with, you know, for example, we have a desire to only take new apprentices on from the Cheddar Valley. So, you know, as long as they can cycle to work, you know, all those sorts of things, which means that they can be independent and they can afford to be an apprentice because they can live at home and all those sorts of things. It's about longevity, and it's about sustainability, not from a green sense, although, you know, that's important too, but it's about sustainability in business. You know, we're not after becoming multimillionaires. We're not interested in selling the company on after 5 years of pushing it, you know, at 100 miles an hour. We're interested in sustainability, where people have really good lives, they get well remunerated for what they do, and they get challenged by really amazing projects. And that's how we see our growth going forward into the future.
And is that, you think, the stamp of your legacy then? You know, when you talk about wanting to be able to move away from the business in 10 or however many years' time, what would you like the legacy of Artichoke and of Bruce Hodgson to be?
I think to continue what we're doing, really. I can't see how it will go backwards. You know, sometimes I have to temper my staff and say, go on, enough. We can't go any further with this. This is good enough. And it's pretty much, it is a legacy, isn't it? I think it's the culmination of, well, I look back on my career and I think, God, you know, actually, we've come a very long way in a relatively short period of time. We've really established a name in our marketplace that is, I think, is held in fairly good esteem and high regard, and for good reason, because the staff work very hard to produce wonderful, wonderful projects with real integrity, and to enable that ship to continue to sail and to grow in its own right without my influence, having set the esprit de corps and its values and so on that people are attracted to anyway, so it's not difficult to do that, it looks after itself. And I can't see it going backwards. As long as we continue to invest in training and invest in young people. So, and I can't see young people running out, you know, I can't see people not wanting to do this stuff. So, yeah, I think it's got a really bright future and I'm really proud of that. And I would be delighted if I'm still pottering around at 85, but given my lifestyle, I doubt it. But if I am set about, I'm sure I can still make a menace of myself. And also, I don't think you ever stop designing. You know, you don't, I can't get up in the morning and not notice things. So it might be that I'm still working in it, but it will be working for the trust and for the people managing it then. And that will be a great legacy. Yeah, I'd like Cheddar to be our artichoke to be a center of excellence 50 years time. You know, that would be, you know, the world's going to change a lot, obviously, but it would be great if that was the, that's certainly the ambition.
Before we go, where can people find out more about you, about the work you're doing, about the company and everything else?
Well, we have a pretty active Instagram account. Website is artichoke.co.uk. So we've had that sort of complicated crossover of URLs and trying to sort of have different addresses and Google engine searches and things like that. That makes it problematic. But anyway, so the website is a good place. There's a lot of information on the website. We also have a newsletter that goes out for those who subscribe to it. And Andrew Petherick looks after our new business inquiries. And he's an expert in what we do. So, and we get published a lot in magazines. Sadly, a lot of the clients are pretty private, and you know, a large amount of our best work will never see the light of day in publications. But you know, there we go, can't have it all.
Bruce, it's been really fascinating talking to you. Thank you for your time and for sharing your story.
Thank you, Lewis. Be very patient.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.